Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Today we have a show continuing from last week on the crisis in Tibet. I'll call it part two, just so we know what it is. And if you listened to last week's show, hopefully it meant something to you. Again, this is a show about metaphysics and spirituality and science, and it's kind of a blending of those ideas. In today's show, I hope to present a more, we'll say, future-oriented proposal about how to deal with the crisis. Last week, which I will very briefly go into this week, I covered most of the historical problems with Tibet, and some of you may not agree with me, or you may have your own comments and thoughts, and if you do, please call in. You can do so if you're in the U.S. by calling 877-876-5227. Those of you in Canada can reach us at 888-815-9756. Okay, so let me quickly give you a rundown of what I said last week historically. For those of you who are unfamiliar with the problems of Tibet, sometime in the late 40s, the Chinese decided that Tibet would be a nice place for them to own and occupy, including controlling the people of Tibet. And they decided that they would give the Tibetan people an opportunity to join them by accepting their constitution and becoming officially Chinese citizens, although they claimed that Tibet had always been a part of China. The Tibetan people, even though they eventually agreed to become part of China, never did agree that China had always controlled them and Tibet had always been part of China before, say, 1950. However, they did agree, and they came to a 17 different agreements, so we can call them accords, in which the basis of their relationship was supposedly spelled out, and they were going to be under the rule of China, but as an independent operated section of China, sort of a sub-nation, and they would be controlled by the agreement and also the Chinese constitution. Well, as it turned out, they found out pretty quickly, the Tibetans did, that the Chinese don't usually tell the truth, and they also have the ulterior motive of wanting to control and basically destroy, unfortunately, anything that deals with meaningful issues about God or religion or anything that isn't putting the Chinese government and regime at the head of power and control. And if you are very religious, as a Tibetan monk might be, or even some of the other people in Tibet, they don't put the Chinese regime beyond God and beyond their religion. So consequently, that put them in a bad place because the Chinese regime found that intolerable. As a result, you bet, they came in and took over and made a military junta, basically, controlling the entire parliament and we'll call it a parliament, part of the political unit of the Tibetan government, and destroyed most of the Tibetan monasteries, the nunneries. They killed hundreds of thousands of monks and nuns. They killed something like 1.5 million people total. The numbers are kind of sketchy because, of course, they don't have a little sign up like "we've served millions" like McDonald's does when it comes to how many people they kill, but the Chinese are certainly very adept at killing people. As a matter of fact, the head of the Chinese government at that time and for many years and even decades afterwards was Mao Zedong, and Mao is probably the world's greatest butcher. No one person in all of history, I don't care who you count, has killed more people than Mao. Hey, what a class to be in, huh? And most people don't know this, that he is actually the prince of murder. And he outstrips, basically, Hirohito and Hitler, Mussolini, all together. all of those people together, if you collectively added up all of them and said, well, how many people did they kill? And then let's add in a few others. You know, we can add in some of the bad emperors of Rome. We can, I mean, you could put in a whole bunch of really bad dudes. And collectively, they did not kill as many people as Mao did. Now, a lot of those people are actually Chinese people, but in some cases, they were not. So it's important to recognize that this is who the Tibetans made their deal with. They made their deal truly with the devil, the most bad guy on the planet, not just for his time, but probably for all time, at least all of recorded history, and at any rate. Okay, so I would call that evil, because one way to define evil is by how much it destroys human life, particularly life in general, and certainly Mao is way up there, way up there. And so this guy just went back on every agreement, all the accords, all the agreements they made together were ignored or only applied when convenient to do so. Now, the Tibetan people and the head of the Tibetan religion, the Dalai Lama, their plan was to try to appease and at the same time find a middle way, some way that they could live together with the Chinese without conflict and there being violence and destruction. And that would work if the Chinese weren't evil. When I say Chinese, I don't mean Chinese people. I'm talking about the regime. So, I mean, this was a real problem because they cut a deal with the wrong people. And they kept their side of the bargain because their religion says that if they make an agreement, they keep the agreement regardless of the consequences. To some extent, this is true. And unfortunately, I don't believe in that. And unfortunately, it doesn't appear to work. And that's the real issue. Some things are ad hoc taken as being the truth applied to all circumstances, and they just don't work that way. I think it's a wonderful idea to want to love everybody and to try to be inclusive and to keep your agreements when others are doing the same. But when others are breaking the agreements and killing 1.5 million or so of your people, I think it's time to forget about the agreement and to do something else. Hopefully you agree too, but if you don't, that's okay. Why I say hopefully, because I have some ideas. These ideas really get into the crux of solving the problem instead of trying to dance around it with accords and middle paths and silly things that actually don't apply. It's silly because I think they don't work. They don't apply to the real world. We are dealing in the physical existence where things are terrible. Destruction is part of the, and mayhem is part of our civilizations. And we need to accept some of this and do something about it to change it rather than to just go on with it. I mean, suffering is not supposed to be like the answer to solving the problem of evil, okay? It's supposed to be a way of understanding compassion, but it isn't a way of getting rid of evil. All right. So, let me continue on. Now, I can kind of slow down because I did that very quickly. I got to catch my breath here. I've been going so fast, but I just wanted to get us up to where we are. Now, if you want to hear the rest of the scenario, the rest of the story, you can go ahead and listen to last week's show, and you'll get a much broader picture of how this all came about. I kind of historically get into it, etc. I don't think that's necessary for us to now entertain the solution. What is the solution to this problem? Well, I present this proposition, this philosophy, you might say, and that is that evil is not really all that interested in getting land. I mean, land is important, and in small circumstances, land may be the reason evil functions. But on a national level, evil's functioning is really about controlling others and having a means of enslavement and eventually destruction of the will of people. So the fact that the Chinese go in and invade and take over the land of Tibet, It's a terrible thing. They've done terrible things to the land itself, destructive things to the environment and to the living creatures, besides humans that are there. But the more important element is to at least curtail the continued destruction of the Tibetan civilization, the Tibetan religion, and the Tibetan people. And in order to do that, my suggestion is to get the heck out of Tibet. Okay? I'm talking about, like, mass exodus here. I'm not talking about a couple people at a time. I'm not talking about announcing it and then gradually doing it. I'm saying everybody gets out as fast as they can, when they can, and organize it in such a way that there's a certain amount of subterfuge about doing it. Now, I know I'm telling everybody about it right now, and believe me, I'm sensitive to the fact that those Chinese people love to listen in. I'm talking about the regime now. Love to listen in and know what the heck we're doing, right? But you know what? There's not enough of a plan here for them to be able to figure out when, how, what is really going to happen. I'm not going to give those kinds of details, even if I had them to give. I'm just talking about the general concept. Get everybody who wants to leave Tibet out. The rest of the people are then considered Chinese citizens, no longer Tibetans, because their choice is to stay. And that's it. It might be half the population, it might be 10%, it might be whatever's left percentage-wise, some significant, but not maybe majority of the people will stay. Hey, listen, that's the way it is. Those people want to be there, that's their karma, that's their life, let them have it. They maybe like the Chinese system of communism. They may think it's wonderful to have this regime control their thoughts and their actions and to kill them if they don't like what they do. That's okay. That, you know, that's freedom. That's their choice. But for the rest, you get them out. Now, where are they going to go? Most of the Tibetans that did leave with the Dalai Lama about 1959, right around this time of the year, by the way, in 1959, those people, the majority of them went to India. Some went to a couple of other surrounding countries. But the majority went to India. And it's wonderful because they are sort of concentrated. But I don't suggest that they stay in any of those countries, especially India. India is a great democracy. It has been generous and helpful to those that have come there. And so have a couple of the other countries that surround Tibet. But it's important to recognize that for the Tibetan people to continue on with both their civilization, their society in general, and their religion, they need to have a country that, at least in part, they can call their own. My suggestion is the following. Now, this may surprise you, but I did start getting into it last week, if you listened. And that is that a deal be struck. It has to be done clandestinely. It has to be done secretly with another country. That country could be anywhere in the world. I don't care of its exact location. And it can be with people of diverse differences between themselves and the Tibetans. The good news about Tibetans is that they thrive best on diversity. And because they cut themselves off and became isolated, they kind of created the problem for themselves with China. Their very nature of being so isolated, while it protected them for hundreds of years, it also led them into being politically isolated from all others, which left them with no alliances, so they couldn't protect themselves. And so this is one of the problems that they self-created. I'm suggesting the opposite. This is a people that are diverse and are capable of being diverse if they choose to. In the diversity, they might go to a country that maybe is predominantly Catholic. Maybe it's Haiti. Maybe it's predominantly some other type of religion completely. Maybe it's Muslim. It doesn't matter. As long as that country seeks to form an alliance with the Tibetan people and is willing to share its government in a singular government of democracy, that would extol freedom for not just Tibetans, but for all people of this world, maybe of other worlds, I don't know, all people who want to come to a place where there is shelter from the storm, where others are chasing him or trying to destroy them. Anywhere and under any circumstances that people need a safe haven, a port where they can move into and become part of, where they're willing to be open-minded, where they're willing to share in freedom and government, where they're willing to be a shining light in this world of gathering darkness around all of us. This is the kind of country I suggest that the Tibetans now form. Now. Not next year, not 10 years from now. Do it now. And do it in a way in which the host country becomes something much greater than what it has been. I would suggest, although this doesn't have to be this way, that a country of great disadvantage is chosen. One that has had marked problems in the past. Maybe disease. Maybe pestilence. Maybe some kinds of wars. Of course, you can't go in the middle of a civil war. That wouldn't really help, would it? But it would need to be some place where the Tibetans can add and others who come there can add. It's sort of like a second United States in a way. Because this would be the new United States. This would be a new kind of country where freedom comes first, and then inclusiveness and love second, and third is right action. And right action is really important in today's world. And this would be the dominant elements that creates the very philosophy and structure behind the new kind of government and also the people themselves. And there is a synergy in this bringing together, as did take place in the United States. Maybe not as much today, but as it happened a century or two ago, yes. By bringing together different cultures and different philosophies, you strengthen and build upon the virtues of each. And you weed out the negative things. You get them to become overpowered by goodness. Now, this would be instilling a tremendous, tremendous kind of spark for the world in this time when so much is falling apart around us. There are many negative things taking place today because of something called the third ray going out and the fourth ray sort of coming in. I mean, there are some really negative effects going on, and will continue for 10, 12 more years, a long time. And so we need something to really look towards. I'm suggesting that the Dalai Lama would be the leader of producing this. Maybe not the political leader of this new country or this conglomerate country, but certainly the leader of producing it, of creating it. It might take him the rest of the lifetime he has here in physical form. And I believe he will live much longer if he chooses this path than if he continues down the one he's on right now. I'm saying his very life would be extended and his vigor, vitality would increase, and he would have great capabilities that he may feel are lacking at the present moment. I hope he's listening to me. I've written him a letter about this, by the way, some time ago, over a week ago. And I'm hoping that he is listening. But if he isn't listening, maybe someone who is listening that has some kind of contact with him will let him know to tune in. He can hear what I'm saying. But at any rate, so this great country now is the bastion of a new type of democracy, a democracy that I have suggested in a simple proposition. Because of the technological advancements, it doesn't take much more than an internet system, which we already have somewhat developed, of course, in the world, and even the smallest level of computers, that people can now have true representative government with most of the political leaders, instead of being, quote-unquote, in control, the opposite. They are advisors, unless the people at large, by a majority, decide not to take the, we'll say, the full force of their abilities and use them to solve various issues or problems. And if that takes place, then these people that, quote-unquote, are semi-elected unofficials who most of the time are nothing more than advisors would then take on the role of being like elected leaders for those specific issues that the people do not come forward with and decide to take responsibility for. Hopefully there'll be very few of those in the long run. And particularly in our new country where people are already very motivated to seek out freedom and to exercise it, unlike the United States, where it could take 10, 20 years for us to move in that direction. They might do it immediately because they understand and appreciate the need for that. Okay, so that's what I suggest as far as a governmental type of structure, the kind of open-ended thing. It could be parliamentary in a sense, but it doesn't matter because if the people truly are mostly the people, those making the decisions in most circumstances, then you truly have a government that can't become tyrannical and corrupt. This is a big problem. Even in the major democracies that we say are so great right now, corruption is huge. Even in the United States, I believe that the United States has major problems with corruption in its government and has for a very long time, maybe even going back to virtually its inception. So we have to be concerned that we don't want this to be the model for the world for our future. We want to see something better. And this new Tibet, I call it, could be the place where this really takes off and it grows and prospers. And it would happen because the very nature of the people coming there would be the impetus for it. The people who are already indigenous would appreciate it because they would then see a way out of their darkness from what has ever been plaguing them. They would be seeing a way to economically, through their economic improvements in other ways, they would be more motivated to take charge of their own government than maybe we in the democracies that are doing so well economically, of course right now things don't look as good, have fallen on weakness and not really taking charge of our own government or electing the best people to be our officials, or making sure that they do what they're supposed to do. You see, this all needs to take place, and that will bring a new light into the world. An additional element that I think can be of help is start a new kind of United Nations, a United Nations of only those countries that not only say they promote freedom, but actually exercise it, based on a developed scale of freedom-producing choices and showing that that people have true free elections and the ability to live their life as they see fit rather than as others are demanding and forcing them to do so. Then you now have a United Nations of free democracies. The other United Nations, I suggest that the free democracies resign from completely. There's no sense in being a member of something that is controlled over half the time by destructive elements of evil empires that are seeking to cause more destruction and more violence, particularly for an organization that has no real say about what's going to take place with those people, because those nations are basically in control. They either have a veto or they ultimately outvote the nations that are otherwise. So what I'm suggesting is if the dark nations want to all stay in what we presently call the United Nations, that's fine. Let's move it out of New York. I wouldn't want to keep it there. But at the same, maybe they could put it in Beijing. I think that might be an appropriate place for it, actually. Or maybe they could put it in the old Tibet. That might be an interesting place to put the United Nations. But at any rate, I'm talking about a new type of world government unit. It doesn't govern the world. What it does is it provides an expression for each nation to find a way of contributing more and more goodness to all the other nations who are doing the same. A building of virtue in the nations that promote freedom and virtue. And do so in ways that are incredible, because freedom is a virtue if you promote it. But nonetheless, so this would be a true, League of Nations as it was originally proposed by the President Woodrow Wilson rather than the United Nations as it came about out of the turmoil after World War II. And I think that we need to have something that is more about the positive, more about the development of nations in right relationships with each other and working together than in a dispository nature of only trying to solve wars and preventing the bad nations from overpowering the good nations. And that doesn't make any sense to me. I don't see that really provides the kind of positive background and agreements that would lead to the mutual benefit of all. So if you disagree with this, by the way, certainly you could come in and say, hey, I think you're nuts. Well, you know, the United Nations, why would you want to get rid of them? Why am I trying to get rid of them? I'm trying to only let them go their own way and instead have a United Nations or your United League of Nations or whatever you want to call it that would do the things that it was originally envisioned to be done in 1917 and 18 than today or even then in 1945. So we need to look at what mistakes have been made in the world and how we can improve upon and change them. We need a fresh sheet of paper, is what I'm suggesting. And the beginning, the top of the fresh sheet of paper can be New Tibet. New Tibet is going to be the country that promotes some of these unbelievably, we'll say, grand ideas, because it will, with one major action, defeat evil. And the way it does that is by bringing all of these people away from the control of the Chinese. It immediately shows how evil can be defeated. One of those ways is to prevent evil from having control over large segments of populations, because that's how it grows. We have to stop it. And the first place to stop it is in the crisis in Tibet. If we can't stop it there, I don't think there's any place on earth we can stop it. And I'm telling you, it's marching forward. This is its plan. Its plan is country by country to destroy the will of humanity by destroying economies, by destroying people, by destroying environments, and eventually by destroying everything that creates more of God. So ultimately, they're destroying God. And there isn't a single one of these evil groups that isn't in some way truly anti-God, even if they claim they are a religious theocracy, such as Iran. I'm going to name some countries now, when in reality they are nothing more than a totalitarian dictatorship hiding behind certain religious tenets that they've twisted and contorted to give them the authority to destroy people and life. I want you to think about that. And we're going to be back in, about 3.5 minutes. We've got an extra commercial in the middle of the show and one at the end. And I would like you to listen to that because it's a sponsor that's someone who's thinking that they would like to promote what we're doing. We appreciate that. And we'll be back in about 3.5 minutes from right now.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. McFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Imagine for a moment that you are transported back to 1909, 100 years ago, but you retain your memory of all the advances which occurred in 100 years. Airplanes, cell phones, the internet, TV, space travel. Now, come back to 2009. Do you think progress will stop? What will be the most significant happening of the next 100 years? Leo Kim's book, Healing the Rift, Bridging the Gap Between Science and Spirituality, will reveal to you the new scientific revolution and the power of the mind, wirelessly connected to the universe, will be the event which changes our world by healing many rifts and by changing our lives. Progress will not stop, and neither will you. Get Leo Kim's book at Amazon.com or visit HealingTheRiftBook.com.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Today we're talking about the crisis in Tibet, Part 2. And it's more than just a crisis, it's an opportunity. So maybe today's show should have been subcategorized, the opportunity in Tibet. But it won't be the Tibet we're familiar with. It would be New Tibet. Of course, I'm just using that to fill in the blank. It could be called anything that's chosen by the people of that new country to be called. But nonetheless, for our own sake, I'll just call it New Tibet. The opportunities in New Tibet would be so wide-reaching. Each citizen of New Tibet would have the opportunity to both educate themselves and to, we'll say, improve themselves so that they could operate in a way which is most productive for their society. Part of the Constitution, I would suggest, would be something different than the constitutions that I'm familiar with, including those of the United States, throughout the world. Constitutions oftentimes say people have the right to be happy, they have the right to do this or that, etc. I would suggest that their constitution might also include clauses that says that each person has a right and a responsibility to help to build the country in whatever way they choose, so that that country could then help to build the world in whatever way it could, and others accepted, and that this would be a far-reaching kind of constitution that touched all other willing and helpful countries. So by its very nature, you could say that New Tibet would also be the new League of Nations as a starting point. Its constitution would enable a constitution for a League of Nations, or a United Nations 2, or whatever you want to call it, that would, in itself, mean that all the people are supporting this right from the get-go. Now, I'm not suggesting a worldwide government. We are nowhere near being able to have such a thing in this world. Right now, our best chance is at free people, through their diversity in their countries, building virtue together without having to give up all of their choices. Because, you see, right now we don't know the right path for anyone. We need to be creatively coming up with paths for groups who find one way better than another. And this can only take place as long as there is a selection and a group, a number of different nations in which they can act together, especially against evil, but they can also find individual expression because of the uniqueness of humans in themselves, and because right now humans are nowhere near inclusive enough to work together as a single unit on a worldwide level. So this is what I suggest for New Tibet. I also suggest that New Tibet find an educational system of a unique and different method than what has been previously promoted. Our present educational system pretty much is based upon specialization and the limiting of a person's abilities. I suggest the opposite, that people can specialize if they choose to about anything they want to, but at the same time, education becomes a generalized method of people building consciousness instead of knowledge. A knowledge-based system, as is promoted in the country I'm from, which is the United States, or most other Western European countries, has great limitations. Knowledge in and of itself oftentimes leads to the more baser levels of human existence. People seek to use the knowledge to, in some way, control and have power over others, in some ways to gain material possessions, and in some ways to have certain levels of what they consider to be security. Whereas the building of consciousness, which is the use of knowledge on a wider and wider scale, applying it to greater and greater levels towards the benefit of others, is completely different. When consciousness becomes the focus of education, people are inclined to become more loving or more inclusive and seek, instead of using what knowledge they have in any particular field for their own benefit, they seek to share it and to have it grow through the knowledge and consciousness of other people. So this is the kind of educational system I suggest. Now, that may be a little bit, you will say, conceptual for some of you listening, and I can't really explain more about it in today's show because that would take a couple shows to explain what it's about. And I'll do that sometime, and I have in the past. But for right now, I'm suggesting that this method be the educational system for New Tibet. New Tibet also would have complete freedom of religion, but I also suggest that the Tibetans look deep into their religion and expand upon some of its principles to make it more universally acceptable to many people, and possibly as a foundation for a commonality between all religions, not to eliminate all other religions, but to provide a commonality of understanding of how there can be a creator of the universe that ultimately is able to be touched and cooperatively created with by all of the sentient beings that it has helped to create, we included. So human beings especially can find and understand their creator and co-create with their creator, and that would be part of the foundation of the New Tibetan type of Buddhism. I'm suggesting sort of a expansion of some of the ideas as they're expressed in Tibetan Buddhism. Not all of them may necessarily lend themselves to this. Some Buddhists do not necessarily believe in a specific creator even. So it's important to understand that I'm not saying everybody would have to think this way, but if it were to be promoted within New Tibet, it could have a tremendous humiliating effects on much of the radicalism we find in today's religions. Some of that radicalism is presently what we call terrorism. So we have to understand that if we don't change the foundations of how we understand our Creator and see our Creator, we are not going to be able to deal with some of the really horrible and disastrous forms of fanatical religions that presently are existent. And it can't come just by trying to preach it or force it on others. We have got to open the minds of people so that they can see in their mind that there is a greater truth besides the particular teachings of one group, person, book, etc. This is so important. And so in New Tibet, we'll call open thinking and thought that is expansive and that challenges people and that gets people to do more thinking and it gets people to become more conscious, including in the educational system, is a critical part of how to overcome the darkness that is growing around us. Now, let me address that darkness directly. Why is New Tibet so needed? Because presently, the countries that we call the free democracies in the world are failing to recognize and correctly deal with evil. Many people in these democracies don't even believe evil exists. Many of them are not even, in a spiritual sense, believers in a creator. We have a real, we'll say, vacuum developing that evil is going to use to possibly take over the entire world. Now, that may sound a little bit of hyperbole, but it isn't. I'm saying it in the truest, most heartfelt sense that it could happen, that country by country we could see our world disappear into a veil of such darkness that the planet will not be survivable. And it will cease to exist. Because when a world goes completely dark, in this part of the universe, it's bye-bye. And we as souls will have to go to another planet to serve in and to work towards developing goodness. Earth is a great experiment to overcome evil. But if evil overcomes Earth, Earth will not continue to exist. That's not such a bad thing. I don't think it's good to have a planet exist that turns to evil in its entirety. I'm suggesting a way of preventing that from happening. New Tibet would be a tremendous marshaling of goodness, and it would start with the recognition that evil is trying to gain control and power over people. So you remove the people from its grasp, and you protect them and shelter them from its grasp. You forget about the concept of borders and land. You say, okay, evil, you have the land for right now, but now you don't have the people. And we'll take the people and we'll build in the people such great virtue that the evil will never be able to come to their new land and do anything about it. How will that take place? Let me give you some ideas. At the present time, we rely upon military means in which forceful measures are used against physical form. We blow them up, we burn them down, we tear them apart, that sort of thing. This is an old method that has stayed with us for a long time, in which wars are fought and people try to deal with the terrible destructive forces around them. But in the future, that may not be the ultimate way of attempting to deal with evil. The ultimate way of dealing with evil is to get people to be so conscious that in consciousness you're able to see sometimes years ahead of time what those who are lacking in consciousness are planning to do. With such abilities, you need to use much less force and much greater levels of we'll say, intelligence and wisdom. This has been lacking and is continuing to grow in lackingness in the free democracies. And as a matter of fact, every time it happens, the democracies become less free. So to overcome evil is to become more conscious and to use the consciousness to plan way ahead of time all of the different ways that evil is going to attempt to do something and to use the least forceful methods because they are so far ahead of the time when evil is going to do something that it doesn't have much of a chance to gain a great deal of force itself. That much less force is needed to counter it, and even wars become less destructive. This is what I suggest New Tibet could teach us by its expansion in consciousness. It could show us that by staying so far ahead of the curve of where evil is headed, that we can overcome and prevent most of the inroads evil has been, unfortunately, successful in for a very long time in overpowering good. We will teach it that it can't do this. And eventually, all but the most severely evil of people will flee and no longer remain part of the evilness. Eventually, there'll be so few evil people that they themselves will destroy each other. The reason they do that is because they demand power, and the power they steal from others. But if there aren't very many others to steal the power from, they destroy each other. And then they clean themselves up, you might say. Now, this is a little bit far out there. I know for some of you it may sound ridiculous, but it's not. It's just that we haven't really followed this paradigm on this planet yet, in recorded history. For those of you who are into Atlantean, etc., types of historical accounts, yes, I know during certain, fairly brief, in standards today, periods in Atlantean history, actually, that did take place, but most of the time it didn't. So, yes, has it happened before on Earth? Yes, but not in a historical sense that most people presently accept. So I'm going with the one that everybody seems to accept more, which is what we have recorded in our history books, etc. There we have not achieved this goal that I'm suggesting New Tibet can follow. This new method of overcoming evil is incredible. Now, it does depend upon something very important taking place within a short time, and that is that we have to become much more conceptually, mentally wise. Our wisdom has to grow. Remember I said that a few minutes ago. Our wisdom has to grow to the point where we think through rather than react emotionally to most of the crises, where we look at and debate and understand. Understanding is the same consciousness. Exactly where and what we need to do and how to defeat certain elements of evil that might not happen for 5, even 10 years into the future. And that we have the flexibility and adaptability to make sudden changes if necessary, because you never know, evil might do something that we didn't anticipate, even though we had developed our consciousness to a much higher level. Because consciousness can never always reach into everything on a human level. Humans are not capable of such, we'll say, perfect levels of thought. But we can certainly improve from where we are. It means that our conceptual thinking has to greatly improve, that we have to look for truth rather than for feeling good. And we have to, instead of getting our short-term desires met, seek the longer-term ideas of wisdom and righteousness, and justice, and truth, for not only ourselves, but for all others who are seeking the light. We don't seek this for those that are functioning in an evil way. I don't want you to think that we are going to go around and try in some way to appease, as many Tibetans have attempted to do in the past, evil. Just the opposite. I am not suggesting that at all. I don't think you can appease people who want to destroy their creator by destroying the growth of their creator, which is life itself. So, you see, those people are not really, you can't just reach out to them and say, well, here's my love and it'll change you. They aren't receptive to that. They may not be in this lifetime at all receptive to that. And instead, I'm suggesting a completely different proposition. Now, what about the actual issue of fighting? I mean, aren't I like most spiritual people thinking that we should all seek peace. We should seek peace, but be willing to fight and even to die for our freedoms and the freedoms of all others. We should be willing to overcome our fear of death by recognizing that we are immortal. And evil is afraid of death because it doesn't truly recognize its immortality except by trying to take from others. When it can't take from others, it is terrified and very frightened. We will frighten evil and weaken it by reducing the amount of people that it controls. And then we will fight if necessary, and only when our wisdom cannot avoid the fighting, and instead we have to use some levels of force to overcome them. Then I suggest we develop the kind of weaponry that destroys just those that are the dark ones, and not even any other kinds of life. Now, that's a new kind of weaponry from what we have used in the past. We have used non-discriminatory weapons that are destructive to almost everything around them. Instead, we have to develop something different. What that is, I leave to those who are into that kind of thought process and genre. I don't want to really encourage it at this time because only the wisest should have such abilities. Only those who have already proven themselves to be the most virtuous should have such abilities and should exercise them. For the rest of us, we should probably not be seeking to have such abilities. But nonetheless, if we have to, we all may have to stand up and fight, if that's what it comes down to. Remember, there is a tremendous amount of evil in the world around us right now, and it is not shrinking, it is growing, in my opinion. It is becoming stronger by the day. There are whole nations that are seeking to destroy other whole nations. There are whole movements and religions that are seeking to destroy other whole movements and religions. And there are amazingly, we'll call it, whole segments of philosophical society that at the present time believe that the best way to exist is through power, control, and if necessary, servitude and destruction of others. This is frightening. And it's a frightening place. But it has been going on a long time. And I don't want you to think that it's just today we're facing these things. The world has been like this for ages and ages. We have been fighting evil in many different ways for a long time. But now it's mostly on a mental level in comparison to any time in the past. And so we must gain wisdom rather than just bravery and valor. We have to truly, to be victorious, become the wisest of the wise. And it is through New Tibet that this is likely to occur. So I encourage those who have some ability to convince those Tibetans that they have a bigger calling to wake up and possibly for the first time in all of history to develop a country from scratch based upon some of the greatest principles and ideas in all of mankind and humankind. Okay, I just want to mention also that if you want to hear some more about this, you can find out next week about it, because we'll talk more about where Mimi is going to be teaching next week. And I do also want to say that we do have a new sponsor, so Steve, please stay in for about a minute after the show and listen in for the person who is presently, or group that is presently sponsoring our show, in addition to us ourselves. Anyway, until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.
People ask Leo Kim why he wrote Healing the Rift, Bridging the Gap Between Science and Spirituality. He wrote it to empower you, to explain how you can discover the spiritual you, reveal your passions, realize your purpose, and find greater happiness in life, how to deal with death and illness of friends and loved ones, and to tell you about the healing mind, how changing your mind can and does change your brain, your health, and your life. Spiritual teachings, when merged with 21st century scientific teachings, will transform our lives. Leo Kim wanted to write in layman's terms for the non-scientists on what exciting benefits will occur in the 21st century when we heal the rift between science and spirituality. Buy Healing the Rift at bookstores, Amazon, or email him for a discounted copy at leo@healingtheriftbook.com.